Commanders of both Tomcat squadrons were with Toland, examining the maps. "Want to keep clear of those SAMs, though. From what the guys in Germany say, the SA-11 is very bad news." The first Air Force effort to flatten Keflavik with B-52s had been a disaster. Follow-up efforts with smaller, faster FB-111s had harassed the Russians, but could not put Keflavik totally out of business. SAC was unwilling to part with enough of its fastest strategic bombers to do this. There still had not been a successful mission against the main fuel storage site. It was too close to a populated area, and satellite photos revealed that the civilians were still there. Of course. "Let's get the Air Force to try another B-52 mission," one fighter jock suggested. "They come in like before, except..." He outlined some changes in the attack profile. "Now that we have our queers with us, it might work out all right."
"If you want my help, Commander, you might at least be a little polite about it."
The Prowler pilot in the room clearly didn't like to have his $40 million aircraft referred to by that nickname. "I can knock those SAM radars back some. Just keep in mind that SA-11 has a backup infrared tracker system. You get within 10 miles of the launchers, they have an even money chance of smoking your Tomcat right out of the sky." The really nasty thing about the SA-11, pilots had learned, was that it left almost no exhaust trail, which made it very hard to spot. And it was even harder to evade a SAM you couldn't see. "We'll stay clear of Mr. Sam. First time, gentlemen, we got the odds on our side." The fighter pilots started putting a plan together. They now had solid intelligence of how Russian fighters operated in combat. The Soviets had good tactics, but they were also predictable. If the American aircraft could contrive to present a situation for which the Russians were trained, they knew how Ivan would react to it. Stendal, German Democratic Republic. He had never expected it to be easy, but neither had Alexeyev expected NATO air forces to have control of the night skies. 4 minutes after midnight, an aircraft that had never registered on their radar had obliterated the radio transmitter station for SyncWest's headquarters. They'd only had 3 alternate stations, each more than 10 kilometers from the underground bunker complex. Now they had one, plus a mobile transmitter that had already been bombed once. The underground telephone cables were still being used, of course, but advances into enemy territory had made telephone communications unreliable. Too often, the cables strung by Signal Corps troops were being destroyed by air attack and badly driven vehicles. They needed the radio links, and NATO was systematically eliminating them. They'd even attempted an attack on the bunker complex itself. The decoy site, set exactly between 2 transmitter stations, had been hit by 8 fighter bombers and liberally sprinkled with napalm, cluster munitions, and delay-fused high explosives. If the attack had been on the real complex, the ordnance expert said, there might have been casualties. So much for the skill of our engineers. The bunkers were supposed to withstand a near miss from a nuclear warhead. He now had a full fighting division across the line. The remains of one, he corrected himself. The 2 reinforcing tank divisions were trying to cross now, but the ribbon bridges had been bombed overnight along with the advancing divisions. The NATO reinforcements were beginning to arrive. Their road advances had also suffered from air attacks, though at ghastly cost to the Soviet fighter bombers. Amateurs discuss tactics, Alexeyev thought wryly. Professional soldiers study logistics. The key to his success would pivot on his ability to maintain bridges on the river Lina and to run traffic efficiently down the roads to Alfeld. The traffic control system had already broken down twice before Alexeyev had dispatched a team of colonels to handle things.
"We should have picked a better place," Alexeyev muttered.
"Excuse me, Comrade General?" Sergeyev asked.
"There's only one good road into Alfeld."
The general smiled ironically.
"We should have made our breakthrough at a town with at least 3.
They watched wooden counters march, creep,
down the line on the map. Each counter was a battalion. Missile and anti-aircraft gun units lined the corridor north and south of this road, and the road was itself constantly swept to rid it of the remotely deployed mines that NATO was using in large numbers for the first time.
20th Tanks has taken a serious mauling, the general breathed. His troops.
It might have been a quick breakthrough. Should have been, but for NATO aircraft.
The two reinforcing divisions will complete the maneuver, Sergeyev predicted confidently.
Alexeyev thought him right. Unless something else went wrong.
Norfolk, Virginia. Mara sat across the desk from Comnav Surflant, Commander, Naval Surface Forces, U.S. Atlantic Fleet. A three-star admiral, he'd spent his whole career in what he liked to call the real Navy, frigates, destroyers, and cruisers. The small gray ships lacked the glamour of aviation and the mystery of the submarines, but right now they were the key to getting the convoys across the Atlantic.
Ivan's changed tactics on us. A hell of a lot faster than we thought he was able to. They're going for the escorts. The attack on your frigate was deliberate. You didn't just stumble across him. He was probably laying for you.
They're trying to roll back the escorts?
Yes, but with particular attention to the ships with tails. We've hurt their submarine force. Not enough, but we have hurt them. The towed-array pickets have worked out very well. Ivan picked up on that, and he's trying to take them out. He's looking for the Sirtash ships, too, but that's a harder proposition. We've killed three submarines that tried to move in on them.
Morris nodded. The surface towed-array sonar ships were modified tuna clippers that trailed enormous passive sonar cables. There weren't enough of them to provide coverage for more than half the convoy routes, but they fed good information into ASW headquarters in Norfolk.
Why don't they send backfires after the ships?
We've wondered about that, too. Evidently the Russians don't think they're worth the diversion of that much effort. Besides, we've got a lot more electronic capability built into them than anyone thought. They're not easy to locate on radar.
The admiral went no further than that, but Morris wondered if stealth technology, which the Navy had been working on for years, had been applied to the Sirtash force. If the Russians were limiting their effort to locate and kill the tuna boats with submarines, he thought, so much the better.
I'm putting you in for a decoration, Ed. You did very well. I've only got three skippers who've done better, and one of them was killed yesterday. So how bad was your damage?
She may be a total loss, sir. It was a victor. We took one hit in the bow. The keel let go, and the bow tore off, sir. We lost everything forward of the Azrak launcher. Lots of shock damage, but most of it's already fixed. Before she'll sail again, we have to build her a new bow.
The admiral nodded. He'd already seen the casualty reports.
You did well to save her, Ed. Damned well. Ferris doesn't need you for the moment. I want you here with my operations people. We have to change tactics, too. I want you to look over what intelligence and operational information we have and feed me some ideas.
For starters, we might stop those damn backfires.
That's being worked on.
The reply held both confidence and skepticism. The Windward Passage. To the east was Haiti on the island of Hispaniola. To the west was Cuba. Blacked out, radar systems fully energized but placed on standby, the ships sailed in battle formation, escorted by destroyers and frigates. Missiles were hung on launchers and trained out to port, while the launch controllers sweated in their air-conditioned battle stations. They didn't expect trouble. Castro had gotten word to the American government that he had had no part in this, and was angered that the Soviets had not informed him of their plans. It was diplomatically important, however, that the American fleet traverse the passage in darkness so that the Cubans could say truthfully that they had seen nothing. As a sign of good faith, Castro had also alerted the Americans to the presence of a Soviet submarine in the Florida Straits.
To be used as a vassal was one thing. To have his country used as a base for a war without being informed was too much. The sailors didn't know all of this, just that no serious opposition was expected. They took it with a grain of salt, as they did all intelligence reports. Their helicopters had laid a string of sonoboys, and their ESM radar receivers listened for the pulsing signal of a Soviet-made radar. Aloft lookouts trained clumsy starlight scopes around the sky, searching for aircraft that might be hunting them visually, which would not be hard. At 25 knots, every ship left a foaming wake that seemed to fluoresce like neon in the darkness. Maylocks didn't work anymore, one frigate captain grumbled to himself. He sat in the command chair in his ship's combat information center. To his left was the chart table. In front of him, he faced aft, the young tactical action officer stood over his plotting scope. The Cubans were known to have surface-to-surface missile batteries arrayed on their coastline like the fortresses of old. At any moment, the ships might detect a swarm of incoming vampires. Forward, his single-arm missile launcher was loaded and trained out, as were his 3-inch gun and Seawiz topside. The coffee was a mistake, but he had to stay alert. The price was a stabbing pain in his upper abdomen. "Maybe I should talk to the corpsman," he thought, and shrugged it off. There wasn't time for that. He'd been working around the clock for 3 months to get his ship ready for action, racing through the acceptance trials and conducting continuous workups, working his men and ship hard, but working himself hardest of all. He was too proud to admit that he'd pushed too hard, even to himself. It came just as he finished his third cup of coffee. For all the warnings, it was a pain as severe and surprising as a thrown knife. The captain doubled over and vomited on the tiled deck of CIC. A sailor mopped it up at once, and it was too dark to see that there'd been blood on the tile. He couldn't leave his post, despite the pains, despite the sudden chill from the blood loss. The captain made a mental note to keep off the coffee for a few hours. Maybe he'd see the corpsman when he got the chance. If he got the chance. There'd be a 3-day layover in Norfolk. He could rest a little then. He knew he needed rest. The fatigue that had been building for days hammered at him. The captain shook his head. Throwing up was supposed to make you feel better. Virginia Beach, Virginia. Morris found his home empty. At his suggestion, his wife had gone home to Kansas to stay with her family. "No sense having you and the kids home worrying about me," he'd told her. He regretted it now. Morris needed the company, needed a hug, needed to see his kids. Within a minute of opening the door, he was on the phone. His wife already knew what had happened to his ship, but had withheld it from the kids. It took 2 minutes to assure her that he was indeed all right, at home and uninjured. Then came the kids, and finally the knowledge that they couldn't arrange a flight home. All the airliners were either ferrying men and supplies overseas or booked solid until mid-August. Ed saw no sense in having his family drive all the way from Salina to Kansas City to wait on standby. Goodbyes were hard. What came next was harder. Commander Edward Morris donned his whites and from his wallet took a list of family calls he had to make. They'd all been officially notified, but another of the duties that came with command was to make the trips himself. The widow of his executive officer lived only half a mile away. A good man with a barbecue, the XO, Morris remembered. How many weekends had he spent in their backyard watching steaks sizzle over charcoal? What would he tell her now? What would he tell the rest of the widows? What would he tell the kids? Morris walked to his car and was mocked by the license plate, FF1094. Not every man got to carry his failure around with him. Most were fortunate enough to leave it behind. As he started the engine, Morris wondered if he'd ever be able to sleep without the fear of reliving again that moment on the bridge of his ship. Iceland.
For the first time, Edwards had beaten his sergeant at his own game. For all his alleged expertise with a fishing rod, Smith had come away with nothing after an hour's effort, and handed the rod to Mike in disgust. 10 minutes later, Edwards landed a 4-pound trout.
"Ain't that some shit," Smith growled.
The last 10 kilometers they'd covered had taken 11 hours. The one road they'd had to cross, they learned, was a busy one. Every few minutes, a vehicle headed north or south. The Russians were using this gravel strip as their principal means of overland travel to Iceland's northern coast. Edwards and his party had spent 6 hours hiding in the rocks of yet another lava field, watching and waiting for a safe time to cross. Twice they'd seen MI-24 helicopters patrolling the area, but neither had come close. They'd seen no foot patrols either, and Edwards had concluded that Iceland was too big for the Soviet force to control. At that point, he'd taken out his Russian map and set to analyzing the symbols. The Soviet troops were concentrated in an arc extending north and south of the Reykjavik Peninsula. He'd radioed that into Scotland, spending 10 minutes describing the Russian symbology. Road traffic had dropped off at dusk, allowing them to cross the road on the run. They'd found themselves without food in another area of lakes and streams. Enough was enough, Edwards had decided. They had to rest again and began fishing to get themselves some food. The next leg of their journey would keep them well clear of inhabited areas. His rifle and other gear lay next to a rock, covered with his camouflage jacket. Vigdis was with him. She'd hardly left his side all day. Smith and the Marines had found places to relax while their lieutenant did most of the work. The local bug population was out in force today. His sweater kept most of them off his skin, but his face attracted its share. He tried to ignore them. Quite a few bugs had found their way to the surface of the stream, and the trout were going after them. Every time he saw a ripple, he cast the feathery lure toward it. The rod bent again. "Got another one!" he hooted. Smith's head came up, shook angrily, and went back down in the bushes 50 yards away. Edwards had never done this sort of fishing. All his experience was in his father's boat, but the principles were pretty much the same. He let the trout pull against the line, but not too much, just enough to wear him out as Edwards worked the rod up and down, drawing the fish upstream and into the rocks. Suddenly he tripped over a rock and fell into the shallow water, managing, however, to keep his rod tip high. Struggling to his feet, he stepped back, his fatigue pants black and wet against his legs. "This is a big one." He turned to see Vigdis laughing. She watched him work the fish in and began moving toward it. A minute later, she grabbed the leader and pulled the trout clear of the water. "3 kilos, this one." She held it up. At age 10, Mike had caught 100-pound albacore, but this brown trout looked a lot bigger. He reeled in the line as Vigdis walked toward him. 10 pounds of fish in 20 minutes, he thought. We might just be able to live off the land yet. The helicopter appeared without warning. There was a westerly wind. It had probably been patrolling the road to the east, and the aircraft was less than a mile away before they heard the stuttering sound of its 5-bladed rotor headed right toward them. "Everyone freeze!" Smith yelled. The Marines were in good cover, but Mike and Vigdis were in the open. "Oh, God," Edwards breathed. He finished reeling his line in. "Take the fish off the hook. Relax." She looked at him as the helicopter approached, afraid to turn around toward the incoming chopper. Her hand shook as she worked the hook free of the wriggling trout. "It's going to be all right, Vigdis." He wrapped his arm about her waist and walked slowly away from the stream. Her arm pulled his body close against hers. It came as a greater shock than the Russian chopper. She was stronger than he'd expected, and her arm was a heated path around his back and chest. The chopper was less than 500 yards off, bearing directly at them, nose down, the multi-barreled gun trained directly at them. He'd never make it, Edwards saw. His rifle was 50 feet away under his camouflage jacket.
If he moved fast enough to get there, they'd know why. His legs were weak beneath him as he watched death approach. Slowly, carefully, Vigdis moved the hand in which she held the fish. She used two fingers to grab Mike's hand at her waist, moving it up and around until it rested on her left breast. Then she held the fish high above her head. Mike dropped his rod and stooped to get the other trout. Vigdis followed his movements and managed to keep his left hand in place. Mike held up his fish as the Mi-24 attack helicopter hovered 50 yards away. Its rotor tossed up a circle of spray from the surrounding marsh.
"Go away," Mike rasped through his grinning teeth.
"My father loves to fish," the senior lieutenant said, manipulating the flight controls to hover.
"Shit on the fish," the gunner snapped back. "I want to catch one of those. Look where that young bastard has his hand."
They probably don't even know what's going on, he thought. Or if they know, they have sense enough not to do anything about it. Nice to see that some people are untouched by the madness that's sweeping the world. The pilot looked down at his fuel gauges.
They look harmless enough. We're down to 30 minutes fuel. Time to return.
The chopper settled at the tail, and for a terrible moment Edwards thought it might be landing. Then it pivoted in midair and moved to the southwest. One of the soldiers riding in the back waved at them. Vigdis waved back. They stood there as it flew off. Their hands came down, and her left arm held his tight against her. Edwards had not realized that Vigdis didn't wear a bra. He was afraid to move his hand, afraid to appear to make an advance. Why had she done that? To help fool the Russians? To reassure him? Or herself? That it had in fact worked seemed unimportant. The Marines were still concealed. They stood there quite alone, and his left hand seemed to burn as his mind stumbled over what he ought to do. Vigdis acted for him. His hand slid away as she turned to him and buried her head against his shoulder. "Here I am, holding the prettiest girl I ever met in one hand," Edwards thought, "and a goddamned fish in the other." That was easily solved. Edwards dropped the fish, wrapped both arms around her, and held on tight. "Are you all right?" She looked up at his face.
"I think yes."
There was only one word for what he felt toward the girl in his arms. Edwards knew this wasn't the time and wasn't the place, but the look and the word remained. He kissed her gently on the cheek. The smile that answered him counted more than all the passionate encounters of his life.
"Excuse me, folks," Sergeant Smith said from a few feet away.
"Yeah." Edwards disengaged himself. "Let's get moving before they decide to come back." USS Chicago. Things were going well. American P-3C Orions and British Nimrods were scouting the route to the ice pack. The submarines had been forced to detour east around one suspected Russian submarine, but that was all. Ivan was sending most of his boats south, it seemed, confident that the Norwegian Sea was under his control. Another 6 hours to the pack. Chicago was drifting now, finished with her turn at the head of the freight train procession of submarines. Her sonar gear searched the black water for the telltale noise of a Russian submarine. They heard nothing but the distant growling of the ice pack. The tracking team plotted the position of the other American submarines. McCafferty was glad to see they had trouble doing so, even with America's best sonar equipment. If they had trouble, so would the Russians. His crew looked to be in good shape. 3 days on the beach had counted for a lot. The beer supplied by the Norwegian skipper, plus word on what their harpoon had done in Chicago's one real engagement, had counted for even more. He'd already briefed the crew on their current mission. The information was accepted quietly, with a couple of jokes about going back home, to the Barents Sea. "That was Boston, skipper," the exo said. "Now we're the caboose."
McCafferty walked back to examine the chart. Everything looked okay, but he checked everything carefully. With so many submarines running the same course track, the risk of collision was real. A quartermaster ran down the list of the sister subs that had passed Chicago. The skipper was satisfied.
"All ahead, two-thirds," he ordered.
The helmsman acknowledged the order and twisted the annunciator dial. "Engine room answers, all ahead, two-thirds."
"Very well. Left 10 degrees rudder. Come to new course 348.
Chicago accelerated to 15 knots, taking her station at the end of the column as the freight train raced to the Arctic. Chapter 31 Demons. Virginia Beach, Virginia. "Left full rudder," Morris screamed, pointing at the torpedo's wake. "Right full rudder aye," the helmsman replied, spinning the wheel right, then left, then centering it. Morris stood on the port bridge wing. The sea was flat calm, and the torpedo's wake was clearly visible, following every turn and maneuver the frigate made. He even tried reversing, and that didn't work. The torpedo appeared to go sideways. It stopped dead in the water and rose to the surface where he could see it. It was white, with what seemed to be a red star on the nose. And it had eyes, like all homing torpedoes. He ordered flank speed, but the torpedo stayed with him on the surface now, skimming along like a flying fish, clearly visible to all who could see. But only Morris saw it. It closed ever so slowly as the frigate maneuvered. 50 feet. 30. 10.
"Where did my daddy go?" the little girl asked. "I want my daddy."
"What's the problem, skipper?" the exec asked.
This was very strange, because he didn't have a head. Sweat poured from Morris's face as he bolted upright in his bed, his heart racing. The digital clock on the headboard said 4:54. Ed got up and walked shakily into the bathroom to splash cold water on his face. The second time tonight, he thought. Twice more during the tow back to Boston, the nightmare had come, robbing him of the few hours of rest he allowed himself. Morris wondered if he had screamed in his sleep.
"You did everything you could have done. It's not your fault," he told the face in the mirror.
"But you were the captain," it replied. Morris had gotten through 5 homes when he'd had to stop. It was one thing to talk to wives and parents. They understood. Their sons and husbands were sailors, and had taken a sailor's risk. But the 4-year-old daughter of gunner's mate second class Jeff Evans had not understood why her daddy would never come home again. A second-class petty officer didn't make much, Morris knew. Evans must have worked like a madman on that little house to make it as neat as it was. A good man with his hands, he remembered. A good gunner's mate. Every wall was newly painted. Much of the interior woodwork had been replaced. They'd been in the house only 7 months, and Morris wondered how the petty officer had found the time to get all that work done.
He had to have done it himself. No way he could have afforded contractors.
Jenny's room had been a testimony to her father's love. Dolls from all over the world had stood on handmade shelves. As soon as he'd seen Jenny's room, Morris had had to leave. He'd felt himself on the verge of breaking down, and some absurd code of conduct wouldn't allow him to do that in front of strangers. So he'd left and driven home, with the rest of the list tucked back in his wallet. Certainly the fatigue that had enveloped him would allow him a night's sleep.
But now he stood in front of the mirror, looking at a man with hollow eyes who wished his wife were there.
Morris went out to the kitchen of his one-story house and went mindlessly through the process of making coffee. The morning paper was on the doorstep, and he found himself reading stories about the war that he knew to be inaccurate or out of date. Things were happening much too fast for reporters to keep up.
There was an eyewitness account from an unnamed destroyer about a missile that had leaked through her missile defenses.
an analysis piece, explained how surface warships were obsolete in the face of determined missile attacks, and asked where the fleet's vaunted carriers were. That, he thought, was a pretty good question. Morris finished his coffee and returned to the bathroom for a shower. If he had to be awake, he thought, he might as well be at work. He had one set of undress whites in the closet. He donned them a few minutes later and walked out to his car. It was already first light when he drove to the Norfolk Navy base. 40 minutes later, he was in one of several operations rooms, where the positions of convoys and suspected submarine locations were plotted. On the far wall, the threat board listed estimated Russian assets and the numbers and types of kills accumulated to date. Another wall showed losses. If the intel guys were right, he thought, the war at sea had the look of a draw. But for the Russians, a draw was the same as a win.
"Good morning, Commander," Comnav Sir Flint said.
Another man who had not slept very much.
"You look a little better."
"Better than what?" Morris wondered.
"We have some good news for a change."
North Atlantic. The B-52 crews were nervous, despite the heavy fighter escort. 5,000 feet above them, a full squadron of F-14 Tomcats flew top cover, having just refueled from KC-135 tankers. The other squadron was tanking now for their part in the mission. The sun was just peeping above the horizon, and the ocean below them was still dark. It was 0300 local time, when human reaction times are at their worst. Keflavik, Iceland. The alarm klaxon jolted the sleeping Russian pilots off their cots. Their ground crews took fewer than 10 seconds to begin pre-flight procedures as the airmen climbed the steel ladders into their cockpits and plugged in their helmet radios to learn what the emergency was. "Heavy enemy jamming activity to the west," the regimental commander announced. "Plan 3. Repeat. Plan 3. In the control trailer, radar operators had just seen their radar screens turn to a cluttered nightmare of white noise jamming. An American raid was coming in. Probably B-52s. Probably in force. Soon the American aircraft would be so close that the ground-based radars could burn through the jamming. Until then, the fighters would try to engage as far out as they could to reduce the number of bombers before they could strike their target. The Soviet pilots had been well-drilled in their time on Iceland. Within 2 minutes, the first pair of MiG-29s was rolling. In 7, all were in the air. The Soviet plan left a third of the fighters over Keflavik while the others charged west toward the jamming, their own missile-targeting radars on, seeking targets. They were 10 minutes out when the jamming stopped. A single MiG got a radar contact off a retreating jamming aircraft and radioed Keflavik, only to learn from his ground controllers that nothing was on the scopes out to a range of 300 kilometers. A minute later, the jamming began again, this time from the south and east. More cautiously this time, the MiGs flew south. On orders, they kept their radar systems shut down until they were 100 miles offshore. But when they switched on, they found nothing. Whoever was jamming was doing it from a great distance. The ground controllers reported that 3 jammers had been involved in the first incident and 4 in the second.
"Quite a lot of jammers," the regimental commander thought. "They're trying to run us around, trying to make us use up our fuel."
"Come east," he ordered his flight leaders. The B-52 crews were really nervous now. One of the escorting prowlers had picked up the voice radio orders from the MiGs, and another had caught a flash of their air intercept radars to the southwest. The fighters eased south also. They were now 150 miles from Keflavik, crossing the Icelandic coast. The mission commander evaluated the situation and ordered the bombers to turn slightly north. The B-52s carried no bombs, just the powerful radar jammers designed to allow other bombers to reach targets within the Soviet Union. Below them, the second squadron of Tomcats was heading for the deck, the eastern slopes of the Vatna Glacier. With them were 4 Navy prowlers for additional protection against air-to-air missiles in case the MiGs got too close.
"Starting to get some airborne radars bearing 258. Seems to be closing," one prowler reported. Another copied the same signal, and they triangulated the range to 50 miles. Close enough. The mission commander was flying a prowler. Amber Moon, say again, Amber Moon. The B-52s turned back east and dove, opening their bomb bays to disgorge tons of aluminum chaff that no radar signal could penetrate. As soon as they saw that, the American fighters all dropped their external fuel tanks, and the prowlers broke off from the bombers to orbit just west of the chaff. Now came the tricky part. The fighters of both sides were closing at a combined speed of over 1,000 miles per hour. "Queer check," the mission commander radioed. "Blackie check," acknowledged the skipper of VF-41. "Jolly check," replied the commander of VF-84. Everyone was in position. "Execute." The four prowlers flipped on their anti-missile jamming gear. The 12 Tomcats of the Jolly Rogers were strung on a line at 30,000 feet. On command, they activated their missile guidance radars. "American fighters!" shouted a number of Russian pilots. Their threat receivers instantly told the pilots that fighter-type radars were locked on their aircraft. The Soviet fighter commander was not surprised. Surely the Americans would not risk their heavy bombers again without a proper escort. He'd ignore these and bore in for the B-52s, as his training dictated. The MiG radars were heavily jammed, their ranges cut in half, and as yet unable to track any targets at all. He ordered his pilots to be alert for incoming missiles, confident that they could avoid those that they saw, and had all his aircraft increase power. Next, he ordered all but two of his reserve force to leave Keflavik and come east to support him. The Americans needed only seconds to lock onto targets. Each Tomcat carried four Sparrows and four Sidewinders. The Sparrows went first. There were 16 MiGs in the air. Most had at least two missiles targeted, but the Sparrows were radar-guided. Each American fighter had to remain pointed at its target until the missile hit. This ran the risk of closing within range of Soviet missiles, and the Tomcats were not equipped with protective jammers. The Americans had taken position upsun from the Russians. Just as their radars began to burn through the American jamming, the Sparrows arrived, the first directly from the sun, exploding its MiG in midair and warning everyone in its flight. The Soviet aircraft began radical jinks up and down, some pilots breaking into hard turns as they saw the 7-inch-wide missiles racing in. But four more found their targets, and in moments there were three hard kills and one severely damaged aircraft that turned to limp for home. The Jolly Rogers turned as soon as their missiles were spent and ran northeast with the Soviets in pursuit. The Russian commander was relieved that the American missiles had performed so poorly, yet still enraged at the loss of five aircraft. His remaining aircraft bore in on afterburner as their targeting radars began to defeat the American jamming. The American fighter escort had had its turn, he knew. Now it was his turn. They ran northeast, their visored eyes alternating between squints into the sun and quick looks at their radar scopes to pick out targets. They never looked down. The lead MiG finally had a target and launched two missiles. 20,000 feet below them, shielded from ground radar by a pair of mountains, 12 Tomcats of the Black Aces went to afterburner. Their radars shut off as the twin-engined fighters rocketed skyward. Within 90 seconds, the pilots began to hear the growling signal that indicated their Sidewinder heat-seeking missiles were tracking targets. Seconds later, 16 missiles were fired from a range of 2 miles. Six Russian pilots never knew what hit them. Of the 11 MiGs, 8 were hit in a matter of seconds. The commander's luck remained briefly as he jerked his fighter around, causing a Sidewinder to break lock and fly into the sun. But now what could he do? He saw two Tomcats running south, away from his remaining fighters. It was too late to organize an attack. His wingman was gone, and the only friendly aircraft he could see was to his north. So the colonel reefed his MiG into an 8G turn and dove at the American, oblivious to the warning buzz of his threat receiver. Both Sparrows, launched from the second group of Black Aces, struck his wing. The MiG came apart around him.
The Americans had no time to gloat. The mission commander reported a second group of MiGs heading their way, and the American squadrons regrouped to meet them, forming a solid wall of 24 aircraft. Their radars shut down for 2 minutes as the MiGs raced into the cloud of jamming. The Russian second-in-command was making a serious error. His fellow pilots were in danger. He had to go to their rescue. One group of Tomcats volleyed off its remaining Sparrows. The other fired Sidewinders. A total of 38 missiles closed in on 8 Soviet aircraft who had no clear picture of what they were running into. Half of them never did, blotted out of the sky by American air-to-air missiles. 3 more were damaged. The Tomcat pilots all wanted to close, but the commander ordered them off. They were all short of fuel, and Stornoway was 700 miles off. They turned east, ducking through the cloud of aluminum chaff left by the B-52s. The Americans would claim 37 kills, quite a score since they had expected a total of only 27 Russian aircraft. In fact, of 26 MiGs, only 5 undamaged aircraft remained. A stunned airbase commander immediately began rescue operations. Soon the parachute division's attack helicopters were flying northeast, searching for downed pilots. Stendal, German Democratic Republic. 30 kilometers from Alfeld to Hameln, Alexeyev thought. An hour's drive in a tank. Elements of 3 divisions were making that drive now, and since the crossing had been achieved, they'd advanced a total of only 18 kilometers. This time it was the English. The tanks of the Royal Tank Regiment and 21st Lancers had stopped his leading elements cold halfway to Hameln and hadn't budged in 18 hours. There was real danger here. For a mechanized formation, safety lay in movement. The Soviets were feeding units into the gap, but NATO was using its air power to the utmost. The bridges on the liner were being destroyed almost as fast as they could be repaired. Engineers had prepared crossing points on the riverbanks, and the Russians were able to swim their infantry carriers across now. But the tanks couldn't swim, and every attempt to run them across underwater, as they were supposedly equipped to do, had been a failure. Too many units had had to be deployed to protect the breach in NATO's lines, and too few were able to exploit it. Alexeyev had achieved a perfect textbook breakthrough, only to see that the other side had its own textbook for containing and smashing it. Western Theater had a total of 6 reserve Class A divisions to send into the fighting. After that, they would have to start using Class B units composed of reservists, with older men and equipment. There were many of them, but they would not, could not, perform as well as the younger soldiers. The general bridled at the necessity of committing units to battle that would certainly take higher casualties than normal. But he had no choice. His political masters wanted it, and he was only the executor of political policy. "I have to go back forward," Alexeyev told his boss. "Yes, but no closer than 5 kilometers to the front line, Pasha. I cannot afford to lose you now." Brussels, Belgium. The Supreme Allied Commander Europe looked at his own tally sheet. Nearly all of his reserves were committed to the fighting now, and the Russians seemed to have an endless supply of men and vehicles moving forward. His units had no time to reorganize and redeploy. NATO faced the nightmare of all armies. They could only react to the moves of their opponent, with almost no chance to launch their own initiatives. So far things were holding together, but only barely. Southeast of Hameln, his map showed a British brigade. In fact, it was nothing more than a reinforced regiment composed of exhausted men and damaged equipment. Artillery and aircraft were all that allowed him to prevent a collapse, and even that would not be enough if his units didn't get more replacement equipment. More ominously, NATO was now down to 2 weeks of ordnance, and the resupply coming from America had been seriously impeded by attacks on the convoys. What could he tell his men? Reduce munitions expenditures? When the only thing stopping the Russians was the profligate use of every weapon at hand. His morning intelligence brief was starting. The chief NATO intelligence officer was a German general who was accompanied by a Dutch major carrying a videotape cassette. For something this important, the intel officer knew, Sackyer wanted to see the raw data, not just the analysis. The Dutch officer set up the machine. A computer-generated map appeared, then units showed up. The tape took under 2 minutes to display 5 hours of data, repeating it several times so that the officers could discern patterns.
"General, we estimate that the Soviets are sending 6 full divisions towards Altveld. The movement you see here on the main road from Braunschweig is the first of them. The others come from their theater reserve, and these 2 coming south are reserve formations from their northern army group."
"So you think that they are making this their main point of attack?" Sackyer asked.
"Yeah,"
the German general nodded.
"The Schwerpunkt is here."
Sackyer frowned. The rational thing to do would be to withdraw behind the River Weser to shorten his defensive line and reorganize his forces. But that would mean abandoning Hanover. The Germans would never accept that. Their own national strategy of defending each home and field had cost the Russians dear, and stretched NATO forces to the breaking point. Politically, they would never accept such a strategic withdrawal. West German units would fight on alone if they had to. He could see it clearly enough in the eyes of his own intelligence chief.
"And if somebody invaded New Hampshire," he admitted to himself, "would I withdraw into Pennsylvania?"
An hour later, half of the existing NATO reserves were heading east from Osnabrück to Hameln. The battle for Germany would be won or lost on the right bank of the Weser. Stornoway, Scotland. The returning Tomcats got little rest. As soon as they landed, the British and American ground crewmen refueled and rearmed the fighters. The Russians were raiding the British northern airfields more carefully now. The American airborne radar aircraft supporting the British Nimrods and Shackletons were making life hard on the twin-engine Blinder bombers flying out of Andøya in Norway. Royal Air Force Tornadoes flew combat air patrol missions 200 miles offshore while the American pilots rested. A few enterprising crew chiefs painted red stars underneath the cockpits, and intelligence officers evaluated gunsight videotapes and recordings of Soviet missile radars.
"Looks like we hurt them," Toland judged.
The kill claims were too high, but with fighter pilots, they always were.
"Bet your ass," replied the commander of the Jolly Rogers.
The Navy commander chewed on a cigar. He claimed personal credit for a pair of MiGs.
"Question is, will they reinforce? It worked once, but they won't fall for that gag again. You tell me, Toland. Can they replace what we culled out?"
"I don't think so. The MiG-29 is about the only fighter they can stage out that far. The rest of those are in Germany, and they've taken a beating there, too. If the Russians decide to cut loose some MiG-31s, I think they can reach that far, but I don't see them releasing their prime bomber interceptor for this kind of mission." The Jolly Rogers' skipper nodded agreement.
"Okay. Next step, then, is we put a combat air patrol close to Iceland and start beating on those backfire raids for real."
"They might just come looking for us, too," Toland warned. "They have to know now what we did and where we did it from." The commander of VF-41 looked out the window. One of his Tomcats sat half a mile away between 2 piles of sandbags. 4 missiles were visible on the airframe. He fingered the Ace of Spades emblem on his chest and turned back.
"Good. If they want to fight us on our turf, in our radar cover, fine."
Altveld, Federal Republic of Germany. Alexeyev left his helicopter on the outskirts of the town and climbed into yet another BMP infantry carrier. 2 ribbon bridges were operating. Fragments of at least 5 others littered the riverbanks, along with countless burned-out tanks and trucks. The commander of 20th Tanks rode with them.
"NATO air attacks are murderous," General Beregovoy said. "I've never seen anything like it.
Even with our SAMs, they close in. We get our share, but it's not enough, and things only get worse as we approach the front.
What progress have you made today?
The main opposition at the moment is English. At least a brigade of tanks. We've pushed them back 2 kilometers since dawn.
There's supposed to be a Belgian force out there also, Sergeyev pointed out.
They've disappeared. We don't know where they are. And yes, that worries me also. I've placed one of the new divisions on our left flank to guard against counterattack. The other will join 20th Tanks when we resume the attack this afternoon.
Strength? Alexeyev asked.
The 20th is down to 90 working tanks. Maybe less, the general said. That number is 4 hours old. Our infantry has done better, but the division is now under 50% nominal strength.
Their vehicle angled down onto the floating ribbon bridge. Each box-like segment was bolted to 2 others, and the vehicle bobbed up and down like a small boat in the surf as they drove across the line. All 3 officers controlled their feelings, but none liked being locked inside a steel box over the water. The BMP infantry assault vehicle was technically amphibious, but many had sunk without warning, and it was rare for anyone to escape when that happened. They could hear distant artillery fire. Air attacks at Alfeld happened without warning. It took just over a minute to complete the crossing.
In case you're curious, that bridge we just crossed holds the record for the longest survival.
He checked his watch.
7 hours.
What of that major you requested the gold star for? Alexeyev asked.
He was wounded in an air attack. He'll live.
Give him this. Perhaps it will speed his recovery.
Alexeyev reached into a pocket and came out with a 5-pointed gold star attached to a blood-red ribbon. He handed it to the general. That major of engineers was now a hero of the Soviet Union.
USS Chicago. All the boats slowed on reaching the ice pack. McCafferty inspected it through his periscope, a thin white line less than 2 miles away. There was nothing else visible. Few ships lingered so near the ice, and no aircraft were visible. Sonar reported a gratifying amount of noise. The serrated fringe of the pack was composed of thousands of individual floes, slabs of ice a few feet thick, ranging in size from a few square feet to several acres. Every year they came loose with the spring thaw and drifted at random until the freeze began again. While loose in the brief Arctic summer, they drifted at random, grinding against one another in a process that destroyed some of the smaller floes, which added to the never-ending groans and pops of the solid ice that went across the top of the pole all the way to the north slope of Alaska.
"What's that?" McCafferty adjusted the scope slightly, turning the handle to the 12-power setting.
He'd glimpsed what might have been a periscope for the merest instant. It was gone now and reappeared, the sword-like dorsal fin of a male killer whale. A puff of spray marked its breath, condensing to vapor in the polar air. Then a few more whales appeared. What was it they called a family of orcas? A school? No, a pod. Up here hunting seals, probably. He wondered if the omen was good or bad. Orsinus orca was the scientific name. Bringer of death.
Sonar, do you have anything at 139?
Con, we have 11 killer whales on that bearing. I make it 3 males, 6 females, and 2 adolescents. Pretty close in, I think. Bearing is changing slowly. The sonar chief responded as if insulted. There were standing orders not to report biologicals unless specifically ordered otherwise.
Very well.
McCafferty had to grin in spite of himself. The other submarines of Operation Doolittle were strung out on a line more than 10 miles across. One by one they went deep and headed under the pack. An hour later, the freight train headed east, 5 miles inside the nominal edge of the pack. 12,000 feet below them was the floor of the Barents Abyssal Plain.
Iceland. Haven't seen a chopper all day, Sergeant Smith observed. Conversation, Edwards noted, made a nice distraction from the fact that they were eating raw fish. He checked his watch. It was time to call in again. It had gotten so that he could assemble the radio antenna in his sleep. Doghouse, this is Beagle, and things could be a lot better. Over. Beagle, we read you. Where are you now? About 46 kilometers from our objective, Edwards replied. He gave them map coordinates. There was one road yet to cross, and only one more row of hills, according to the map. Nothing much to report, except we have not seen any choppers today. In fact, we haven't seen any aircraft at all. Edwards looked up. The sky was pretty clear, too. Usually they spotted fighters once or twice a day as they patrolled overhead. Roger that, Beagle. Be advised that the Navy sent some fighters over and beat them up pretty good around dawn. All right. We haven't seen any Russians since the chopper looked us over. In Scotland, his controller shuddered at that. Edwards went on. We're down to eating fish we catch, but the fishing's pretty good. How's your lady friend? Mike had to smile at that one. She's not holding us back, if that's what you mean. Anything else? Negative. Okay, we'll be back if we see anything. Out. Edwards flipped the power switch on the radio pack. Our friends say the Navy chewed up some Russian fighters today. About time, Smith said. He was down to his last 5 cigarettes and stared at one now, deciding whether or not to reduce his supply to 4. As Edwards watched, he opened his lighter to poison himself again.
We go to Hamsjorda? Vigdis asked. Why?
Somebody wants to know what's there, Edwards said. He unfolded the tactical map. It showed the entrance to the bay to be crammed with rocks. It took him a moment to realize that while the land elevations were in meters, the depth curves on the map were in fathoms. Keflavik. How many? The fighter regiment commander was lowered gently from the helicopter, his arm tied across his chest. Ejecting from his disintegrating aircraft, the colonel had dislocated his shoulder, and then his parachute had landed him on a mountainside, giving him a sprained ankle plus several facial cuts. It had taken 11 hours to find him. On the whole, the colonel considered himself lucky, for a fool who had allowed his command to be ambushed by a superior force. 5 aircraft are mission capable, he was told. Of the damaged ones, we can repair 2. The colonel swore, angered in spite of the morphine that coursed through his veins. My men? We've found 6, including you. 2 are uninjured and can still fly. The rest are in the hospital. Another helicopter landed close by. The paratroop general got out and came over.
Good to see you alive.
Thank you, Comrade General. You are continuing the search?
Yes, I have detailed 2 helicopters to the task.
What happened?
The Americans staged a raid with heavy bombers. We never saw them, but we could tell from the jamming. They had fighters mixed in with them. The bombers fled when we approached.
The Air Force colonel tried to put the best face on it, and the general did not press him. This was an exposed post, and such things were expected. The MiGs could hardly have ignored the American raid. There was no point in punishing this man. The general had already radioed for more fighters, though he didn't expect any. The plan said they would not be necessary. But the plan had also said his division had to hold the island unsupported for only 2 weeks. By that time, Germany was supposed to be fully defeated, and the land war in Europe mainly over. He received reports from the front that were mere embellishments of the news on Radio Moscow. The Red Army was driving on the Rhine, and they'd been driving on the Rhine since the first day of the damned war. The names of the cities under daily attack were strangely left out. His intelligence chief was risking his life by listening in on Western radio broadcasts. The KGB regarded it as a disloyal act, in order to get an idea of how the fighting was going.